Consciousness, involved and not apparent in matter, first emerges in the disguise of vital vibrations, animate but subconscient. Then, in imperfect formulations of a conscient life, it strives towards self-finding through successive forms of that material substance, forms more and more adapted to its own completer expression. Consciousness in life, throwing off the primal insensibility of a material inanimation and nescience, labors to find itself more and more entirely in the ignorance, which is its first inevitable formulation. But it achieves at first only a primary mental perception and a vital awareness of self and things. A life perception, which in its first forms depends on an internal sensation responsive to the contacts of other life and of matter. Consciousness labors to manifest as best it can through the inadequacy of sensation its own inherent delight of being. But it can only formulate a partial pain and pleasure. In man, the energizing consciousness appears as mind, more clearly aware of itself and things. This is still a partial and limited, not an integral power of itself, but a first conceptive potentiality and promise of integral emergence is visible. That integral emergence is the goal of evolving nature.
So here, Sri Aurobindo is following up from the previous chapter where he talked about the three terms of the manifestation. An involution of spirit in the unconscious is the beginning, an evolution in the ignorance with its play, with the play of possibilities of a partial developing knowledge is the middle, and a consummation in a deployment of the spirit, self-knowledge and self-power is the culmination. So it is this process which he is making the beginning of this chapter. But here he has turned his gaze on this particular process from the viewpoint of the emergence of knowledge from ignorance. So it is that the involution is an involution of Satchidananda, existence, consciousness and bliss, into a kind of inconscience, involution in an inconscience, the apparent inconscience of matter. Inconscience meaning a sleep of consciousness, a latency of consciousness. A latency of consciousness is actually also the condition of pure existence, Sat. Sat is a purity of existence in which consciousness has become latent. But this latency is not really a sleep. This latency is like an equable distribution of consciousness, a neutrality of consciousness. There is no active power of consciousness in Sat. That's why Sat is conscious. But consciousness is like a intrinsic neutral property of Sat. In the inconscience, this latency is a kind of disappearance, an absence. Not a real absence, but in an absence in effect due to a kind of sleep. So there, Sat is represented as another kind of pure existence, but a pure existence which lacks consciousness. Not conscious in itself. And that is matter. So in this particular condition, material condition, the powers of a conscious being, conscious and self, sort of delightful being, begin emerging. That is the evolution out of the involution. The evolution takes place gradually, first through the establishment of the principle of Sat in matter as a pure existence, then the emergence of consciousness. A consciousness emerging in a graded fashion, gradually, as one might say, first emerges as a kind of enlivening of matter itself. That part is very interesting. Sri Aurobindo is talking about the emergence of consciousness in matter. Consciousness involved and non-apparent in matter first emerges in the disguise of vital vibrations, animate but subconscient. This is almost like saying that the principle of life is present in matter itself. And indeed, you know, there's the sort of attempt made by scientists like Jagadish Bose to show some kind of vital, you know, principle working in matter, working in metals, for example. He did some experiments and tried to indicate this reality of the vital vibrations in matter. Furthermore, today there is a certain kind of attempt to arrive at the origins of life. And we know now that the origins of life go into fundamental material organic compounds that in some sense are becoming more and more sort of, you know, or less and less obvious as living substance. Molecules that don't have necessarily any genetic material. Even those are actually, in some sense, showing themselves to be having the property of life. Properties of self-conscious survival, for example, of mutation and adaptation to circumstances. So these vital vibrations, they make their appearance in a very rudimentary form within matter itself, even prior to the organization of life in matter. So then you have the beginnings of a conscious life, the imperfect formulations of a conscient life. It strives towards self-finding through successive forms of that material substance, forms more adapted to its own completer expression. So here is where we find consciousness making its emergence as life, as a different and new principle within the inconscience of matter that has been given a certain kind of independent reality. So when it emerges, as it were, using this material principle, two things happen. One is that it seeks to override materiality. It seeks to change, transform matter into living substance. And on the other hand, it becomes subject to the law of matter. So this is what happens to life when it to emerge in
Actually, you're breaking quite a bit to the last minute or so.
It's power of consciousness is an extremely limited one. It is, in some sense, a kind of first only a primary mental perception and a vital out, which in its first forms depends on an internal sensation responsive to the context of other life and of man. So here is the beginnings of the organism of the vital being in matter. There is a certain rudimentary mentality to it. as a higher form of consciousness. But it's like a mental perception, as he says. And then we have that higher formulation of mind. The energizing consciousness appears as mind, more clearly aware of itself and things. So here we find a reflexive property. That is, consciousness is self-conscious. It is not merely conscious of certain things, but it is conscious of itself as a power of consciousness. That is why it is more clearly aware of itself and of things around it. But this also is a limitation. It is a limitation because it is a separative form of consciousness. In its emergence, right from the previous stage where it emerges as life, it is emerging not merely as consciousness but also as delight. So we find that this separative sense of consciousness cannot but be limited and partial and express itself through dualities. These dualities are dualities of liking and hating. So the joy that we experience is as he says, a partial pain and pleasure that is inevitable in the separative condition. Similarly, we find that when mind emerges, there is a root of separativeness to the self-awareness of consciousness in mind. And this root of separativeness is ahankara, ego. It takes itself as a center of awareness and thinks around it as, in some sense, not itself. Now, this clearly is not an integral emergence of consciousness. So, this problem or this process is something which is a stage but indicates a completer. But indicates a completer emergence, a more integral emergence, which somehow is trying to express itself inadequately through the properties of inconscience, of a progressively conscious inconscience. So as he ends that paragraph by pointing to the goal, that integral emergence is the goal of evolving nature.
Did we do something?
Nothing. I'm pressing a button.
We lost the John. Let's call again.
Yes, I think somebody is trying to. Hello.
Hey, let's tell him. Yes.
Yeah. Is everybody online now?
Mira, let's call
Mira. Mira is missing.
Yeah. Can you call?
How do you do that?
Okay, Mira has internet problems. I think we can continue. When she is online, she'll send me a message.
So, Devashish, I have one question about this paragraph. Somehow you've been. I don't know. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I got interrupted by a call from a lady from India who would like to be included in this conference. Let me see what I can do. I mean, I'm going to sort of see if I can locate her.
Does she have an ID?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to see. I don't think you know her, so she just asked me to send details, and I did, but I'm trying to see if I can locate her ID.
Okay.
Just one moment.
Okay.
How would I know? Oh, okay. Also, Punita is coming on.
Okay.
And then this lady's name is Mina Singh. I don't know if you can locate her.
Mm-hmm.
That's M-I-N-A or?
Yeah, M-I-N-A. Last name S-I-N-G-H.
Okay.
Add contact.
And then there's Punita as well, who tried to get on and then I think dropped out, or got cancelled or something.
Oh.
Mina Singh.
Mm.
There's a Mina Singh, India, New Delhi.
That's the one.
Okay.
Oh, that's
Meenakshi.
No, there's another Mina Singh above. You can try that.
United States. Mina Singh. Okay. Let's try that.
Left and wrong.
Right.
So Devashis, I had a couple of probably related questions about the first paragraph.
Yes.
So when we say there is this emergence of what is already latent within, how does that go with, somehow we've gotten the notion that the mind and the life and the supermind, they represent breaks in the evolution rather than a smooth coming out. And related to that again, so if it is an emergence, so then when we say that Sri Aurobindo and the mother are bringing down the supermind from elsewhere, what do we mean there? If what is happening is only an emergence.
Yes, that's a good question. Here, in fact, the process is not being developed. He's talking about it in terms of an involution and an evolution. But later, he will point out that the process is one in which these powers that are involved are actually involved in a seed form. That is, in fact, in a symbolic sense, we find that there are, like what we may say in a very primitive way, the tree is locked up in the seed. But we can't see the tree in the seed. It needs a variety of operations to make the tree emerge from the seed. So similarly, in this particular case, the process of emergence is not being dealt with. It's just being talked of as an emergence. But as a matter of fact, these principles are latent in an unmanifest form inside in conscience. That's the involution. And so to appear as manifestation, there has to be a certain process. And that process includes, on the one hand, a kind of an aspiration, and on the other hand, descent. So it's instead of saying descent, we may say a double pressure, a pressure to evolve and a pressure from above to make evolve. So it's this double pressure that causes the emergence to occur. Otherwise, we would not have any access to the manifestation of these principles, which would remain latent, as it were.
Yeah, sure, there was that. So the emergence of mind and life in matter also was such a process of aspiration and descent, but probably done by nature unconsciously?
Yes, not unconsciously, consciously, but in an occult fashion. In other words, the conscious power in nature has been at work. This is why Sri Aurobindo is saying all life is yoga, and that the processes of nature are subconscient yoga, as he says. But really, it's an occult process by which, you know, the universal principle of matter, the universal principle of life, universal principle of mind are on the one hand, you know, sort of pressing from below, and on the other hand being actually sort of pressed on from above by the original plane from which these things have come. So, because the original plane above is present, that seeks to, you know, sort of cause the evolution from below to take place. So it is this pressure from above that, and the sort of, I mean, emergence of the response from below that in some way causes the evolution to take place. Now, as a result, what Sri Aurobindo is saying is that this is an inevitable process. Now, supermind's emergence is also as inevitable as the emergence of matter, life, and mind in conscience. And it will occur whether we interfere in its process or not. But the human being is a conscious agent who can accelerate this process.
So the symbolic story of the avatars, so every time an avatar comes, so from like from fish, so it's like the story of evolution. So can we say that it is actually the story of this higher pressure, or that the grace that comes down and pulls or brings out that which is latent inside matter?
Yeah, this is true, and it's a little bit even more than that, because as a matter of fact, if we just talk in terms of impersonal principles of consciousness, then we can talk in these terms that there is an ascent and a descent, a sort of a pressure from above of the plane of consciousness, and an ascent from below or a sort of response from below of the same plane that is latent in conscience. But there is one more aspect to this whole thing, and this is the reason why, you know, Sri Aurobindo makes such a point of the central message of the Gita, which is that of the avatar, which is that actually of the Purusha, and in that sense of the Purushottama. So the idea of the Purushottama is that this reality is not just a reality made up of impersonal planes of consciousness, but is a being. And as a being, it is actually a person. So this person aspect of it is what is in some sense, you know, the central quality of the planes of consciousness in their emergence or in their pressure. In a sense, you realize that when Mother talks about, you know, the manifestation of the supramental in 1956, she's talking about the supramental consciousness, light, and power, which are impersonal principles. But in 1969, on 1st January, she had another realization. And she said that what descended from that particular day was the consciousness of the Superman. A consciousness of the Superman is basically that Purusha consciousness, the Purushottama in that sense, which is not merely the impersonal principle, but the being of that, the person aspect of that consciousness. So that is, in a sense, what the whole story of avatarhood is. And in one way, this emergence is an emergence of the person, of the Purusha, not merely of an impersonal principle. And in the human case, what is happening is that there is a unification sought at the individual level between the Purusha of a certain spiritual plane and the human being. That's why there is an individualization, one may say, of the entire creation becoming conscious at the level of the human. The Gita is a theistic text. And it's very interesting because in a sense, without allowing or accounting for this theistic element, we are missing out on something. And that something is the individuation of consciousness, the emergence of Purusha. I think you have a question.
Oh, hi, Devashish. Hi, everybody. Can you please distinguish for me our use of the term Purushottama in absolute? Absolute is absolute. I mean, I know there's nothing beyond that. That's the highest one. And the divine is a nice word, but Purushottama and absolute.
Purushottama would be the person aspect of the absolute. In other words, it's transcendental and unimaginable. So this is the supreme person, as one might call it. But in the emergence, what one finds is that this Purushottama manifests itself in graded forms of personhood. And this personhood is something which will emerge without end. So, if one asks, for example, the whole notion of the Vishwarupa, where something is seen by Arjuna, but it is so, beyond any descriptive, power, that all he can manage is to say that if everything is contained in you, you are a dazzling radiance, and all forms are in you, etc. But what is this form? In some sense, it is a form that in some way is moving towards greater and greater manifestation in time. And that is what the evolution is all about, in becoming more adequate to this supreme person.
As long as we've gotten that far, where would you place the use of the word divine? Would that be just a very uncertain terminology, piece of terminology?
No, not really. Actually, the word divine, as Sri Aurobindo uses it, he uses it in two forms. There is a certain haziness about it in his usage. He uses the word divine sometimes to mean overmental and sometimes to mean supramental. Divine mind, for example, is his terminology for overmind sometimes. And Indra is known as the Lord of the divine mind in that sense. But sometimes he'll use divine to mean the supramental being.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think I've got it, but I think you can tell me now the relationship of the supramental being, the divine in that sense, and the Purushottama.
Supramental being would be the divine in the sense that it is a Purusha, supramental Purusha or supramental person that forms the being of the truth consciousness. But when we are talking about Purushottama, we are actually talking about the absolute person, the Supreme Person. So the Supreme Person is in some sense beyond all descriptive ability, beyond quality. So it isn't, it is like the sort of, you know, pinnacle of all possible descriptors. But as long as we are actually talking in terms of consciousness, we are talking in terms of a gradation that moves from ignorance to knowledge, and in knowledge of various gradations, there these Purushas are the representation or representatives of Purushottama. So supramental Purusha is the representative of Purushottama on the plane of truth consciousness.
Devashisda, could you, I don't know how much we'll understand it, but could you speak a little more about the difference between the event of 1956 and 1969, and how, and what the difference between the two events are?
It's actually very esoteric. It's very difficult to say, but all I can kind of sort of, you know, speak about as a possibility is that the descent and manifestation of Superman consciousness in 1969 makes it possible for the individualization of the supramental consciousness to take place in human life. In other words, in a certain sense, one may say that what Sri Aurobindo calls the triple transformation is a gradual transformation of the psychic being. The psychic being first, or an evolution of the psychic being. The psychic being first becomes the master of nature. Okay, it comes to the front, becomes the controller of matter, life and body, life and mind. But then it cosmicizes itself by coming into complete union with the cosmic being, or with the overmental Purusha. And then the overmental Purusha's powers are brought into matter, life and mind to transform them into the key of an overmental nature. Then this transformed status is raised further high, and the individualization of the being in supermind takes place. In other words, one may talk of a union of that status of psychic being with the supramental Purusha. And then a bringing of the supramental powers into the nature, matter, life and mind to supramentalize them. This is in essence the triple transformation. Now if one says that supramental being or Superman consciousness is present on the earth, in a way what we are saying is that it is now much, much more possible for this particular kind of union to take place at the individual level, at the psychic level, with the supramental Purusha. That in some sense was hardly accessible before. Because as Sri Aurobindo has pointed out, the overmind was in some way the limit of the ignorance. One could, in one's ascent, unite with the overmental Purusha in some very high consciousness, and that union was considered to be in some sense the acme. Bringing of its power into the nature was also not even envisaged. That became only possible if the nature had already been prepared by the psychicization of the nature. And then the rise and individualization of the being in overmind, and then consequent transformation of the nature. But to go beyond that was only something which Ishwar Koti people can do. You know, something of the nature of an avatar can do. But to make it possible for the, you know, realm of humanity to assimilate this higher consciousness, even than the overmental cosmic being, the descent of Superman consciousness is necessary.
Yeah, okay.
Somebody You see, in the also in the preparation of the being, Sri Aurobindo has pointed out that we have to actually develop certain, even one might call occult centers above the mind. One has to form a consciousness which is over mental. That in some sense, all those ranges of consciousness from higher mind to over mind have to be established in us. And only beyond that can supramental consciousness be naturalized, one may say. But in some way, the descent and manifestation of a superman consciousness makes all these things much more easy. That in some sense, that can do it for us. What would have otherwise been almost like a superhuman tapasya becomes much easier.
Okay.
Because the being or the model or the archetype that already contains that particular formation that would have otherwise have to have been made, which in some sense was made by beings like Mother and Sri Aurobindo, is much more present on earth right now as a model.
So the Bashis, the sages like Yajnavalkya and all, when they had the darshan of the Shukla Yajurveda, so is that also the supramental? Because I think that the sun is a symbol of the supramental light.
Yes, there's no doubt that, you know, both in the Veda and in the Upanishads, there has been access to the supermind. And in some way, some degree of understanding of that consciousness and what it may bring or what its pressure is doing. You know, the pressure of the supermind has also been experienced. But working out the consequences of a transformation of nature through the supermind is something that only now is opening up to us due to the special work done by Sri Aurobindo and the Mother.
Mm-hmm. And reaching the overmental consciousness means reaching the cosmic consciousness.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yes, that would be nice.
Meera, you want to read?
Yeah, I can read. Man is there to affirm himself in the universe. That is his first business, but also to evolve and finally to exceed himself. He has to enlarge his partial being into a complete being, his partial consciousness into an integral consciousness. He has to achieve mastery of his environment, but also world union and world harmony. He has to realize his individuality, but also to enlarge it into a cosmic self and a universal and spiritual delight of existence. A transformation, a chastening and correction of all that is obscure, erroneous and ignorant in his mentality. An ultimate arrival at a free and white harmony and luminousness of knowledge and will and feeling and action and character is the evident intention of his nature. It is the ideal which the creative energy has imposed on his intelligence, a need implanted by her in his mental and vital substance. But this can only be accomplished by his growing into a larger being and a larger consciousness. Self-enlargement, self-fulfillment, self-evolution from what he partially and temporarily is in his actual and apparent nature to what he completely is in his secret self and spirit, and therefore can become even in his manifest existence is the object of his creation. This hope is the justification of his life upon earth amidst the phenomena of the cosmos. The outer apparent man, an ephemeral being subject to the constraints of his material embodiment and imprisoned in a limited mentality, has to become the inner real man, master of himself and his environment and universal in his being. In a more vivid and less metaphysical language, the natural man has to evolve himself into the divine man. The sons of death have to know themselves as the children of immortality. It is on this account that the human birth can be described as the turning point in the evolution, the critical stage in Earth nature.
So, in a sense, you see, he's also drawing on what he has introduced earlier here, in that these principles of emergence in the ignorance, aspiring towards consciousness, aspiring towards knowledge, causing to emerge greater and greater powers of consciousness from within, cannot sufficiently embody the meaning of this particular emergence until there is an individualization, until an individual being comes that can take this particular evolutionary process into an individual phase, accelerate it and give it a certain form that ultimately embodies the supramental being, or the integral consciousness, as he calls it over here. This also, in some sense, gives justification to the whole notion of the Aitiriya Upanishad, of the succession of creatures and the final acceptance of the human being by the gods as the vehicle for unity with Purusha. So we find that, as Sri Aurobindo points out over here, here he's used, as Michael was asking, the term divine man. And the divine man here is equable to the integral consciousness of the supramental Purusha. Now, that particular process is something which requires the embodiment of that Purusha in a personal form, in an individualized form. And that's the reason why the human birth is such a magic lever, one may say, a key, a mysterious key, which is the turning point in the evolution, the critical stage in Earth nature. And so we see that there is a certain meaning to human life, to the human birth, a very profound meaning, a meaning which is far in excess of our knowledge and imagination even of ourselves. And that's why, as he says, we have to start where we are by affirming ourselves in the universe. In other words, by attempting to sort of stamp the universe with our own consciousness, to affirm ourselves, to humanize, to turn to our own use the universe. But that is also a certain ego goal, a goal which is ultimately marked by human ignorance. It can only achieve its own fulfillment if that consciousness can evolve to become integral, to become one with the cosmos, to become one with the universe, to know itself to be one with the universe, and then to even transcend that, to transcend it, to know itself to be one with that out of which the universe has been emanated. So that is why that self-exceeding is a natural you know, sort of aspiration within the human being. He has to enlarge his partial being into a complete being, his partial consciousness into an integral consciousness. And in this paragraph, you find that he has, in a kind of a nutshell form, already introduced those three steps, the steps of the psychic transformation, the cosmic or spiritual transformation, and the supramental or integral transformation. He has to realize his individuality, that itself is the psychic transformation, but also to enlarge it into a cosmic self and a universal and spiritual delight of existence. So that is the, you know, exceeding of the individual, or the individual formula, to a full possession of the oneness of the individual with the entire cosmos, the full possession of unity with the cosmic being. And then beyond that, to rise into the consciousness of the immortal being, the being of spiritual delight, as he's saying over there. A transformation, a chastening and correction of all that is obscure, erroneous and ignorant in his mentality, an ultimate arrival at a free and wide harmony and luminousness of knowledge and will and feeling and action and character is the evident intention of his nature. It is the ideal which the creative energy has imposed on his intelligence. And this ideal, you know, it's again something which Sri Aurobindo has used in a variety of ways, this term ideal. He uses it as something which belongs to mind, almost like a Platonic world of ideas. That is the ideal mind in some sense, which one can also equate with the overmind. But he also uses ideal and in a number of cases to equate it with the supermind, because that is the ultimate ideal, the ultimate idea, the world of idea out of which the entire manifestation has sprung, not just as a mental idea, but as he calls it, as a real idea, an idea which is reality itself. So that is the ideal which the creative energy has imposed on his intelligence. So from that particular level, there is a certain kind of descent of the idea into the mind of the human and into the aspiration of the human, so that he may embody that, a need implanted by her in his mental and vital substance. But this can only be accomplished by growing into a larger being and a larger consciousness. So that is the thing where this whole issue of ultimately going deep into oneself to realize or recognize the true individuality, the psychic being, and then to enlarge it, completely unite it with the cosmic being, is what gives this possibility. If we can know our unity with the all, then we can have a secure play of the each, of the individuals in the cosmos. So that is why he points that as the goal of the human existence. That this hope is the justification of his life upon earth amidst the phenomena of the cosmos. The outer apparent man, an ephemeral being subject to the constraints of his material embodiment and imprisoned in a limited mentality, has to become the inner real man, master of himself and his environment, and universal in his being. In a more vivid and less metaphysical language, the natural man has to evolve himself into the divine man. Sons of death have to know themselves as the children of immortality. So that indeed becomes the goal of human existence. And also the justification and vindication of nature's labor to evolve the powers of divinity within itself.
Devashish, when we say attaining the cosmic self and realizing the individuality, that is the psychic and the spiritual transformation, they're really two completely different steps which may help each other, correct? Or are they more things that go together?
They go together. They can each be attempted by themselves, but they do go together because ultimately the psychic being is coded with this particular kind of aspiration towards universality. The psychic being in its evolution has got three components to it. One of them is the component of greater and greater mastery over nature. That leads to the psychicization of the nature. The second one is a greater and greater universalization of self. That leads ultimately to the union with the cosmic being. And the third is a greater and greater ascent into the roots of its own origin. That ultimately leads to the union with the supreme mental being. You can also think about these realizations as three dimensions of consciousness. The plunge into the depths is what brings us into contact with the psychic being, because it is the innermost being in us. So either one waits for something to emerge from the depths by really drawing on it, by concentrating on the depths. It's often given in the image of a well of honey in the heart of man. And then the emergence of this ultimately rises to another dimension, the dimension of width, which is the width of the cosmic being which embraces everything, out of which all things in the universe are formed. And then finally, there is the height dimension, which is the dimension of transcendence, and that is where it rises into its own origin, which is in the knowledge sphere above the Vidya.
So the way the supramental descent helps is by creating that urge to the inner life. Would you say that? I mean,
Yes, Father. Hello.
Yeah, I mean, So the way the supramental descent helps is, the presence in the earth consciousness itself creates some kind of an aspiration in the individual for this life.
Yeah, for this life, you were saying. Yes, yes. Yes, indeed. Now, this is intrinsic to the psychic reality. The psychic reality already has this aspiration. But the psychic reality is hidden far behind or within our existence. The descent and manifestation of the supramental consciousness consists in some sense of making active this pressure from above. Otherwise, it is constantly active as an influence, but not active as a conscious pressure directing the movement of the universe. The universe is left to its own devices, but there is a certain kind of influence, a help, one may say, if within the universe there is some opportunity of progress, of bringing forward the aspiration, bringing forward the psychic, then the supermind is there to help it. But the descent of the supermind means that there is a certain kind of purpose, a certain kind of direction, a directedness to the evolution of the universe now, which is going in some sense to open up this aspiration in a universal way. So that is a big difference, because that means in some sense that the destiny of the earth has in some sense been already sort of, you know, directed or is being directed by this particular power of force. The net result will be, as you have said, the awakening of aspiration in humans. In a sense, the coming to the sort of much greater fore of the psychic being, and it's becoming active with its own aspirations in our lives.
Devashish, I had a question.
Yeah. Yes, Mrs.
Do I just speak? Okay, I was wondering if I had to press any keys.
No, I can hear you fine.
Okay. This is regarding... to achieve mastery of his environment.
Yes.
Mastery of his environment. He's really mastery of oneself. But do you
yes.
think there could be other meanings to environment, to the word, or to the phrase mastery of his environment?
Yes. Yes, you see, actually those three sentences, starting with man is there to affirm himself in the universe, that it is his first business, but also to evolve and finally to exceed himself. That sentence can be taken almost as a sort of a synonymous sentence to the one that you read. He has to achieve mastery of his environment, but also world union and world harmony. And then the next one too, he has to realize his individuality, but also to enlarge it into a cosmic self and a universal and spiritual delight of existence. So, terms like this, mastery of his environment or affirming himself in the universe, then mastery of through histological mastery.
Entirely now.
We couldn't hear you, Debashista.
I think I'm...
Yes, I lost your voice completely.
Oh, couldn't hear?
It wasn't... And now I can hear you.
Okay, what I was saying is that...
No, I'm sorry, I've lost you again. I'm sorry for this.
Can you hear me now?
Well, just this last sentence, so maybe I can work on the connection later and not hold up the session.
Yeah. So, that's all right. So, mastery of his environment is something that we can understand depending on what level we are looking at it. Either if we are looking at it from the level of the ego, it is a certain kind of exploitation of nature. And, you know, a certain mastery of the environment, meaning a technological sort of use of our environment. But if one looks at it, we see that that kind of a mastery is not true mastery, because that leaves us with too many problems. It's not a true mastery, ultimately, is the notion of what Sri Aurobindo, using the ancient Vedic terminology, has called Samrat. Samrat is world master. And Samrat is premised on Swarat, master of the self. So exactly as you were pointing out, mastery of the environment is premised on mastery of the self. So that is the first step, to come to arrive at a true control of the forces of nature around us. And that can only be done by a true control of the forces of nature within us. But even that is only a first step. And as he's saying, out of that there must grow a greater step, which is that of world union. That of coming into union with all various, all consciousnesses, the cosmic consciousness which contains all consciousnesses on earth. And then he's talking about another step there, world harmony. World harmony is even greater than world union, because world union presupposes that there is one consciousness which unites everything in the world. But how to put its components in place? How to arrive at a dynamic proportioning of things? This is what the Veda calls rhythm. And this rhythm can only be arrived at in its truth if we come to the supramental consciousness. So in this sentence itself, again, he is establishing a whole gradation of realizations.
Yes, I'm looking at the first sentence again. To affirm himself in the universe, to affirm himself in relation to other aspiring men and women, and to achieve mastery of his environment, that is, other men and women.
Yes, other men, women, as well as other...
That,
the environment, or what he's calling here the universe, affirming himself in the universe, is the entire universe of beings. That is, not only the human universe or the social universe, which consists of other men and women, but also the natural universe, the universe of other creatures, as well as the material universe, the universe of material resources. So, both in terms of the universe as well as in terms of that environment, he is talking about our relationship with the entire environment, the human, natural, and material environment.
This paragraph has a very good roadmap of what needs to be done by man.
Oh, I have a question. Can you tell us a little bit to distinguish what the consciousness of the supermind would be versus the consciousness of the overmind? The qualities, differences.
Yeah, I think it's actually in this particular case, it's a little beyond our scope. We get to that at a certain point, but basically, you know, the sort of the over-mental consciousness is a consciousness of different ideals. You know, one can come to a sense of the unity of things. But it is almost as if this unity is configured in a variety of ways. Each one of these ways can present itself as the totality. That's why it is also known as the world of the gods. Now, each one of these gods is in some sense the entire divine. But in some sense, it doesn't know itself to be identical with every other divine. See? It's almost as if the refraction has already taken place. It knows itself to be every other divine, but it cannot lose itself in one consciousness and therefore become every other divine. You see? So that oneness, which in the Vedas sort of description, it talks about the sun, where it says the sun unyokes his horses. Okay? The horses are the rays of the sun. which in some sense are the sun. Each ray is the solar substance. But nevertheless, it is a individualization of the solar substance. But in the sun itself, you have the origin of all the rays. So there is the transcendence of the cosmos and its multiple formulations into something which can then reformulate the harmony of the cosmos. To come to universal or cosmic being, to come to overmental being, is to come to a union with the manifestation as it is right now. But come to a union with the supramental being is to arrive at a consciousness which can reconfigure the entire cosmos.
So, Devashishda, so just like this triple transformation, which seems they are like rather big steps, similarly, the realization of the inner mind, the inner vital, are they also distinct landmarks in the journey, or are they more spoken of in more general terms of, hey, you start living the inner life and that would be the living in the inner mind and the inner vital?
Yes. Inner mind, inner vital, etc. compose the inner being, or what is called the inner instrument, antahkarana. Now, what Sri Aurobindo is pointing to is ultimately arriving at the innermost being or psychic being, but we don't have direct access to the psychic being to start with. Just as there is a whole gradation of planes connecting our mind to the supermind or even the overmind, so too there is a gradation of planes connecting our surface consciousness with the psychic being. That gradation of planes are the inner planes. So we have our inner sheaths, you may call them, inner bodies. So these are the inner mind, inner life, inner physical, whatever you want to call it. Now, realization of the inner mind, inner vital, etc. is not something that we seek in and by itself. It is something that we may have access to because of a predominance in a certain direction in each case. The psychic may express itself through one of these as an aspiration which we first experience. In some cases, it may express itself as an aspiration through the inner mind. In some cases, through the inner vital or whatever. Now, in each of these cases, we first make our progress over here. And that progress can bring us a certain realization. It can bring a certain spiritual consciousness into that particular plane, into the inner mind, into the inner vital, etc. That can aid us ultimately in finding the psychic being and also in establishing some aspects of the psychic and spiritual consciousness in the instrumentation and therefore transformation of the nature.
So they are not distinct centers by themselves to be pursued.
They are distinct centers, but they are not goals in some sense that they actually come to us because we have a predominance in one direction or the other. They are distinct centers in that each one of these has got a Purusha to it. Each one of these has got mystic centers in it. And then there is a Purusha behind each one of these, the mental Purusha, the vital Purusha, and the mental Prakriti, the vital Prakriti, the physical Purusha, the physical Prakriti. These are the very being of the inner mind, inner vital, and inner physical. the being of the inner mind, the inner mind being, is the inner mental Purusha. So now Sri Aurobindo will point out that depending on the kind of person each one of us is, there is a more active or awakened sense in any one of these beings that composes what he calls the central being in us. So the central being in each individual or human being is to start with different. But the true central being in all of us is the psychic being. This is the ultimate true central being. And so we have access to it in terms of one or the other of these particular beings. And therefore, realizations or experiences through these particular sheaths are what we often start with. But these become occasions through which we can come into contact with the power of the spiritual consciousness or the psychic consciousness, and then thereby attain to some degree of integration, attain to some degree of transformation.
Yeah, very helpful. So when we say central being, to begin with, you're pointing out that it really is not the same for every person. So based on the predominance of the nature, that sense of centrality may lie different at different points.
Absolutely. Yes. That is how our nature is configured, so that there is a certain kind of, one might say, pre-coding of a certain a predominance of a certain Purusha in the being. That is the central being in each of us. But in the process of the triple transformation, we shift our central being, and ultimately all of us have to find the true central being, which is the psychic being, and make that the central being.
I have a question. Maybe the answer can be brief, because I think it's the least important part of this discussion. But I would like to know, what would be the nature of the inner physical being, the inner sheath that reflects that inner plane of the physical, and what might be a getting closer to that, what might be the manifestation of that in this life that we lead?
Yeah, actually, that becomes an important issue in this yoga particularly. And both the mother and Sri Aurobindo have talked quite a lot about it. Particularly, Sri Aurobindo has very interesting things to say about it in the record of yoga and also in the supramental manifestation, where he's talking about the divine body. But essentially, the inner physical being is the being that is in control of our physical being, our physical existence. And its experience, I think the most primary experience or the most easy experience of it is when one has certain sense of a perfect stillness of the body. When there is an absolutely perfect stillness of the body, one sometimes suddenly becomes aware of the body as a Purusha, as a being. And this being, if it becomes sufficiently awakened, then controls certain functions of the body. The body becomes conscious. The body nature shows itself to be under the control of the psychic, of the physical Purusha, the physical being, inner physical being. And also certain siddhis or properties arise. That these were the properties, some of the properties that Sri Aurobindo was experimenting with in the record of yoga. Some of them being things like properties of lightness. Okay, he talks about lightness, laghuta, and that means ultimately it leads to the siddhi of levitation. Then properties of some kind of a indestructibility. Okay, there's some way in which nothing can pierce or penetrate the physical. And other properties of luminosity. Okay, so, and then the ability to sense using the entire body, even turning, you know, sort of different parts of the body into sensing organs. So these kinds of siddhis, one may say, are all results of coming to union with the physical Purusha. And the other thing is harmony of the body, beauty and harmony of the body. Sri Aurobindo was actually very actively, this particular siddhi, the Rupa Siddhi, as he called it, is something that he was very actively experimenting with, because his belief was that in some sense the psychic image, the ideal that each person carries ought to be manifest in the body, and that manifestation occurs through the physical Purusha. The physical Purusha actually controlling the perfect image in the physical nature. So getting rid of disease, Arogya, as he calls it, then ultimately leading to indestructibility and conquest over death, as well as getting rid of disproportion in the body. These are all features, and then the other features of lightness and other kinds of siddhis are all features that come from that particular inner physical Purusha.
Question on the joinder with the inner vital sheath. How would you compare the progress that we would make there to the problem, as Freud formulates it, as a unworkable unconscious, the repository of all of these vital tricks and so forth? What would be the difference in our perspective on that? Perhaps.
Yeah, that is a very large subject, the subject of the purification and transformation of the vital and the vital subconscient, as we call it in our terminology. And that ultimately, you know, is something which bringing consciousness into those levels is something which is also a triple progress. And again, it's the same thing, that partly none of these powers can completely transform these lower parts. There is a relative degree of transformation that is possible through the psychic, an even greater degree of transformation that is possible through the overmind, and the complete degree of transformation is possible through the supramental shakti. Purification of the vital energy itself, as you were pointing out about the physical being. So there is a vital being, a vital Purusha. And purification of the vital Shakti itself can take us very far. And it does. And that's the, one of the whole sections of the yoga of self-perfection in the synthesis of yoga. Interestingly, at that time, Sri Aurobindo is using the term psychic prana, but that particular, those particular chapters were not revised. And so when he's using the term psychic prana, he's meaning more subliminal consciousness of the vital.
Yeah. Shall we read another paragraph?
Yeah, let's read one more before we stop it for today.
Sita, you want to read?
Actually, I have some background noise, so it's better somebody else reads.
Okay. Mahesh, do you want to read?
If you can hear me, okay, I can read.
Yeah, we can hear you, Sita. And it doesn't sound like there is any background.
Okay.
Sorry about that, Mahesh.
Yeah. It follows at once that the knowledge we have to arrive at is not truth of the intellect. It is not right belief, right opinions, right information about oneself and things. That is only the surface mind's idea of knowledge. To arrive at some mental conception about God and ourselves and the world is an object good for the intellect but not large enough for the spirit. It will not make us the conscious sons of infinity. Ancient Indian thought meant by knowledge a consciousness which possesses the highest truth in a diet of perception and in self-experience. To be the highest that we know is the sign that we really have the knowledge. For the same reason, to shape our practical life, our actions as far as may be in the consciousness with our intellectual notions of truth and right, or with a successful pragmatic knowledge, an ethical or a vital fulfillment is not and cannot be the ultimate aim of our life. Our aim must be to grow into our true being, our being of spirit, the being of supreme and universal existence, consciousness, delight, Sachidananda.
So it's a very loaded small paragraph, but it actually sets the entire goal of human existence. And in setting the goal of human existence, he's also revising the goal of human existence. Because we already come preformed with certain goals. And we find that in some sense, this text is a kind of a cross-cultural text. It assumes a certain state at which humanity has reached. And this condition of humanity today is a global condition. He is writing in the English language and he is writing to a certain understanding of our human condition and human goals that we have absorbed, that we have assimilated through world history. And that is, in a sense, the Western notion, what one might actually trace back to the Greeks. The Greek aim or goal of life is a sane mind in a sane body, okay, a sound mind in a sound body. And an ethical life that is actually sort of fashioned after a mental control over the life forces. Now, this kind of ideal, which is really a kind of an ideal which ultimately in its heights moves close to the world of the gods, but achieves its temporary and in some sense precarious balance through a certain utilization of mental tapasya, is still a kind of a limited goal, an extremely limited goal compared to what Sri Aurobindo has set out to be the ultimate office of the human consciousness. So over here he's drawing that particular logic out and making it very clear that the goal of our lives as well as of our knowledge has to take into account this particular evolutionary trajectory of the human consciousness. that when we talk about knowledge, we are not talking about just coming into the information regarding our environment, regarding our relation with things around us. But we are coming to the notion of a knowledge which is not never, which is never fully known unless it is experienced. Okay? So this is where the whole notion of the difference between idea and real idea comes in. Idea ultimately is the mental sort of, access to things around us, the representation, the schematic of our world formed inside the mind, created as a map or a plan. And that understanding, that representation, is what we then turn upon the world through our life energies to bring into some kind of mold or shape of control over the environment. Now this sort of double process, this arriving at knowledge, which is a knowledge of the mind, and this control of one's own nature as well as the nature around us, in the image of the representation formed by the mind, cannot be a sufficient goal for the human consciousness that has made its notion of knowledge much greater. A notion of knowledge which is never fully satisfied unless it experiences what it wants to know. So that's why he's saying over here, we cannot make this kind of a knowledge, a mental knowledge, into our goal of knowledge. Our knowledge can only be secure and fulfilled in itself if that knowledge is a true possession and experience of that which it seeks, and B, a visioning of that particular experience in sight. That is what is called pratyaksha, to know by direct sight and to know by identity. So these two, in fact, these two are also in some senses contradictory, because to know by identity, one would think, is to lose the sense of self-reflection, is to lose the ability to objectify oneself, to look at oneself. But as a matter of fact, intrinsic to this particular kind of experience is a duality, the duality by which the one knows itself as its own subject and its own object. That is the pratyaksha. That is darshan. That's why that darshan is a pratyaksha darshan. And that darshan is also a knowledge by identity. So that's what he's talking about here in terms of what is the goal of knowledge. Now that leads, in a sense, to the goal of action. And there he points out that the goal of action cannot be a representation of knowledge in the mind turned upon the nature. Okay? For the same reason, to shape our practical life, our actions, as far as may be in consonance with our intellectual notions of truth and right, or with a successful pragmatic knowledge, an ethical or vital fulfillment is not and cannot be the ultimate aim of our life. And here, in a sense, we go back to that previous paragraph and come to a deeper understanding of what it means for man to affirm himself in the universe or to achieve mastery of his environment. It isn't just a kind of intellectual control over the forces of nature by knowing them as information and manipulating this information through power. It is a coming into union with the consciousness of the world, with the consciousness of the environment, and a transformation of the nature through the power of that union. And that's why he's saying over here, our aim must be to grow into our true being, a being of spirit, the being of the supreme and universal existence, consciousness, delight, Satchidananda.
Devashish, this is Mahesh.
Yes,
ma'am. I just wanted to get a deeper insight into this point that it may not be the ultimate goal, but it appears that you cannot bypass the traditional right thought, right action, mentally driven ethic in the sense that it may not be the ultimate goal, but you still have to maybe pass through that. Is there something that that you can say about whether, you know, it's entirely something to be minimized?
I know, no, in a sense, you see, it depends on what you have access to. So, you know, the kind of power of the mind to, in some sense, approximate truth, to work towards truth, to create certain kinds of codes and canons, is something which is useful in, as a purification, as a purificatory step. But it must always be understood as that. It must be understood as a temporary, as a crutch, to be thrown when there is an exceeding. Cannot be understood as the goal. So that's why, you know, Sri Aurobindo has a chapter in the synthesis of yoga. It's called Standards of Conduct and Spiritual Freedom. Now, in this particular chapter, or is it in the human cycle? In this particular chapter, is pointing to the fact that we need standards of conduct because we are moving from ignorance to knowledge. And in the process, there is a certain kind of stability, a dynamic stability that needs to be maintained using the best faculties that are available to us at any point. But it should be understood at any stage that these are temporary resting houses, that they are sort of, in some sense, you know, already known to be overpassed. And so, at every stage, there is a kind of a acceptance, but also a knowledge that there'll be a reshuffling, a reorganization based on a higher truth.
Thank you. Furthermore, there was maybe, you know, I'm coming back to the basics perhaps on where, you know, a lot of the subject matter may have already traversed, but the idea that there is a descent in order to have an ascent, and in conjunction with the idea of a perfection that cannot be made any more perfect, you know, it appears to be hard to reconcile or combine those two points of view. That is, if there is a descent in order to be a greater ascent or a greater perfection, then it appears to have, you know, merits of purpose, if you can, you know, ascribe such a thing. But when on the one hand you say that there is the original source is, it cannot be further perfected, then this whole disguise and coming back and hide and seek, etc. I'm trying to find the reason for that methodology, you know, of its finding itself.
Yeah, but then where is the notion of something which cannot be perfected any further?
Well, you know, that's the one of your favorites, the purna which cannot be made any fuller, or etc. If that is the case, then the whole process of these iterations may not lead to anything further than what is already there.
Yeah, but then you see, this is the thing. The thing is that there is one absolute reality which cannot be made any more absolute because it is absolute. But in its manifestation, because its absoluteness is an infinity that can ever be explored, there will never be any end to the amount of or the degree of manifestation possible of that. So it's almost like saying that there are two sides to it. One is the consciousness, which one can become one with. That's why there is the notion of the unknowable. The unknowable is unknowable because you can know it more and more and more and yet not know it. That so-called knowing is the pratyaksha part of it. That is the ability to objectify it as knowledge, even to talk about it, to describe it. Okay, there is no end to it because it is ultimately unknowable. It is ultimately unknowable because it is ultimately infinite. Anything which is infinite, one can never come to a full formulation of. At the same time, it is knowable by identity. In other words, the consciousness can be one with it. Consciousness being one with it knows it to be itself, but at the same time cannot objectify itself in full adequacy except through a session which is ever becoming more and more perfect, which is what the manifestation is all about.
Interesting. I missed a few words. I think I sometimes get a sort of a squiggle in the voice. Missed the last few words, but that's, I don't know if you can recap it.
Yeah, I was saying that in consciousness, one might experience identity with the absolute, with what has been called the unknowable. Therefore, it is known through identity. But knowledge through identity is not knowledge as describable. Knowledge as describable is manifest knowledge. And manifestation is something which always will move into greater and greater approximations, but never exhaust the fullness of the absolute. So that is where also the whole notion of that Purnam contains the paradox of being and becoming. That in some sense, as being, it is whole, it is integral, it is perfect, it is stainless, as the Upanishad says. And at the same time, as a becoming, it can be explored forever without being exhausted.
Okay. I think that's the key. I think is not so much an arriving, but a continuous exploring. That appears to resolve this, because then it's just continual finding of new areas of something that's just constant.
Yeah, but at the same time, you see, if one was to talk only of a continual finding, then one would talk of a becoming without a being. One would say that there is something which is constantly seeking and will never find. The paradox of it is that the divine has already found himself, but is still seeking himself.
That's the exact paradox. So the paradox remains a paradox.
Right. That is what the Purnam hymn is saying, in fact. It's saying that it is integral, it is the whole, it is the totality, and yet you are adding to it and you are taking from it, yet it remains the totality.
So the adding and taking, that process is there for the fun of it, I think. I guess that's what it's said. It's not as, I mean, although all
those activities,
in a playful way, I suppose, it's supposed to be all fun. I missed the critical few words, Devashish, that he just said.
In fact, yeah, I don't know, I couldn't hear you properly.
How about now, is it better?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just saying that then it must be just for the Leela part of it. The fun part of it, what it's looking for, etc., but that there's going to be all these different areas to explore.
Yes, it can explore itself ad infinitum. Because you see, the fact is that that's what makes this particular consciousness, whatever we are calling Purna, one of the problems that we have with it as human beings is that our consciousness is finite. And therefore, or at least our self-consciousness is finite. And therefore, we think of this as a magnified finite consciousness that already knows itself. And therefore, what is the delight, what is the point of trying to know itself beyond that? But the thing that we don't catch is that qualitative difference between an infinite consciousness and a finite consciousness. An infinite consciousness in possession of itself is still mysterious to itself.
It's all brilliant and wonderful, Dikshishin. I think your reflection of this magnificent stuff is quite something. So I thank you.
I think we should wrap up now. Yes, Lopesh.